It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hartglass, and welcome. It's time for It's All About Food. Repeat after me. It's all about food. Okay, so for the next hour, we're going to talk about food and connect the dots a bit because it is all about food. And there are just so many different things that go on in our lives every day. And when we think about our food and where it comes from and what it does to us when we eat and what happens to it while we're growing it and shipping it all around the world, it touches just about everything. And we're going to be talking to someone who writes quite a bit about it, and I'm going to bring on Molly Semester, who is the founder of Eatcology.com. Eatcology.com, a blog focused on the nexus of ecology, design, and community food systems. She holds a Master of Landscape Architecture from the University of Virginia, as well as a Master of Education and a BA in Art. She is a published author, most notably Designing a Landscape for Sustainability in Action Bioscience, the online journal of the American Institute of Biological Sciences, and The Biggest Picture, Global Food and Hunger Issues for Planning magazine, the flagship publication of the American Planning Association. Welcome to It's All About Food, Molly.
Hi, welcome. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, me too. I recently discovered your blog, and I love it, and I just wanted to talk to you because I just love the concepts you're bringing up and the important issues you're bringing out that need to be...
I'm so pleased to hear that.
...that we need to be talking about these things.
Okay. And it is about that cross-connectivity. We've gone through this age of intense specialization of people whose... medical focus or law practice or whatever it is, they focus down, narrowed in on some tiny little piece, which is a wonderful way to really hone in on something and explore that topic and learn more, but the connectivity of how it all puts together, I believe we're entering an age of generalists, of people being needed to connect the dots, to put the various things together.
Yeah, that's such an important theme for me, and I'm glad we're going to be talking more about it. And I don't know very much about you, but one of the things that I like is that you bring art to whatever it is you're doing, or you have an appreciation for it. And I think that's also part of connecting the dots.
I think it is.
You know, when you do, yeah. Continue.
Go ahead.
No. You tell me.
Oh, I was just going to say that I went to college. Here's this bright, promising young person, writes pretty well, can do these various things, and I wanted to major in art. And luckily, my mother is a musician, had taught piano for years while I was growing up, but hadn't believed in her own musical capacity enough to allow herself to major in music going through college. So she let me major in art, but I continually got from various people, well, what do you even do with that? How is that going to teach you? And I can't tell you how valuable an art education is, especially when it comes to something like painting, like at an intense scale, or sculpture. There's so much problem solving that goes on. There's so much thinking about issues from a variety of angles. The initial art classes that most people take just scratch the surface.
Well, the art is really important, and I think, unfortunately, we have so much artistic void these days because we're so focused on making profit and money and don't realize how important it is. And we'll get to ecology and all that, but I just kind of wanted to
kind of create a little, a few basic brushstrokes here.
Sure.
But I was just listening to the show just before us where they were talking about wind farms briefly and, you know, how people are upset sometimes because they think wind farms are ugly. And there's a way we can create beauty in everything we do. Nothing has to be ugly. And if it has a benefit, I think we can put beauty in everything we do. And that should be an important part of it. When I talk about food all the time, and when food is presented on a plate, it can be the simplest food or the most extravagant, but why not make it lovely? It just makes the entire experience so much more gratifying.
Yes, it appeals to all the senses.
And the last thing I wanted to say, and then I'm going to let you talk, is I studied art a little bit, and I studied color. And what always fascinated me was when you took one color and put it in a background of another color and then changed the background, that same color would look completely different. And
mm-hmm.
we cannot ignore the whole picture. Because it is all connected, not just from an artistic point of view, but just from a health and sustainability, it's all connected. And we have to, specialization is great, but we have to keep in mind everything else around it because we could do something specific and not realize the repercussions, and it could be just a horrible domino effect.
Yeah, oh, and you often just completely accidentally. I love the color theory metaphor that you brought up. Of orange surrounded by blue versus orange surrounded by red, and how they look like two totally different oranges, even though they're the exact same shade. And I'll take that back to the wind farm idea. In addition to the form of the wind turbines, which at the moment we're used to these sort of airplane propeller props, and that's not necessary. I mean, there are other forms that will catch the wind, that will generate power. What's also not a given is the scale. Everybody who's working on wind farms well, I shouldn't say everybody, because guaranteed somebody out there is doing what I'm about to suggest. Right now, most of what I'm seeing is happening on a very large scale. But we can shift that scale. We can take that same idea, surround it with a different context, and come up with a very different answer. When power grids began to be interconnected, they took them out of the cities and put the power generation in a separate spot. They called it centralization. Well, it was centralized for the power generators, not for the cities. It was out of the city centers.
Mm-hmm.
As we're relocalizing food, why not also relocalize power generation? I remember I lived in Washington, D.C. for quite a while, and coming up the escalators, if you come out of the metro stations, anytime you go up those escalators, it's a constant wind tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of the DuPont Circle or whatever, it's, why not a little row of micro wind turbines right there?
Why not?
The pressure differential between being at the surface and being underground by the trains naturally, automatically creates electricity.
Mm.
So why not catch it? Why not light that station with that?
Brilliant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm seeing that happening with food, too, where people are trying to solve issues. It's the scale jumping that's causing a little bit of problem because people are working, they want to work on urban stuff and whatnot, and they want to get bigger. They're like, oh, we got to feed more people. And so I would see architecture students designing skyscrapers that were intended to be large, multi-floor hydroponics gardens, and they would ask me what I thought, and I would take a look at their picture, and inevitably I could find somebody and say, you know, farmers don't wear lab coats. Like, you inevitably draw somebody in a little white coat standing there. I was like, no, farmers don't wear lab coats. This is not how these people dress. Because it's not what that job requires. But they're looking to, those students were in their attempts to solve those issues, going back to some of these 1960s ideas of building new structures to grow food. meanwhile, look out of this structure, look across the city, we have a plethora of rooftops. There's no shortage of rooftops. Why not figure out how to combine the local food movement and the green roof movement to extend food production in urban areas?
We have this bigger is better concept, and it touches everything, and I think we're learning slowly now that bigger is not always better, and we definitely need to bring things to a small scale. And what I love about it is that it brings the importance about how change is done by the individual, how we are all part of the solution. We can all participate and make a difference, and that's all beautiful. And you have a post on your site, ecology.com, about things going on in other countries like in Cuba and Venezuela. And I thought we could talk a little bit about that because it's somewhat related. We're going back to the small scale and how that benefits in so many ways.
What happened with Cuba was amazing and really, I hope, doesn't quite happen this way to anybody else. I guess you can get to the same place without taking the same path. But when the Soviet Union dissolved, Cuba suddenly didn't have any oil coming in. It didn't have, literally, there was no gas to drive the tractor with. There was no ability to move fertilizers and chemicals out to the fields. There was no ability to take what grew in the fields 150 miles from the cities to the city. Everything ground to a total halt, and it was horrible because the average calorie consumption, you know, between 2,500 and 3,000 calories a day, more than 1,000. They were down to between 1,400 and 2,000 calories. This is way inside the zone where the UN really starts to pay attention and figure out if they need to start shipping food in. This is really tripping on famine territory. And they went through it, and somehow we were all just ignorant of the fact because we're so blind to what's happening down there. But they very quickly figured out how to do organoponicos, is what they call them, and they are these in-city farms. They can be very small farms. It used to be that a farmer didn't feed 600 people. A farmer fed a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were many more farmers because there were many more farms, but each farm was smaller. And in an urban area, something like that makes more sense. And in Cuba, they developed various systems of the farm and the market being right there, and you would go up and ask for what it was you wanted, and somebody would trot out into the field and pick your order for the day and bring it back to you, just incredibly fresh. Because if somebody didn't want that squash today, it could sit on the vine for another week and be okay.
Right.
And but if I pick it, suddenly the clock's ticking of, like, how long is this going to last? Well, they took the knowledge from Cuba and some folks from Tanzania, too, who the UN had worked with. And the UN has developed a system that is, I think, incredibly dignified and respectful, where they talk about South-South relations, where various countries who are not the first-world countries, who are not the totally industrialized, developed nations, talk to each other about how to solve the problems. Figure out how to transfer their knowledge from one person to another, from one community to another. So they brought folks from Cuba and folks from Tanzania into Venezuela and used Caracas, Venezuela as a test site to see if the idea was transferable and if it was scalable to cover a whole city. Could this be done somewhat more intentionally? And it did work. It definitely worked. They took, I'm going to forget off the top of my head how many hectares, but a lot of the city, and made organic farms right there in the city. They were run, a lot of them, by cooperatives. so that the income was shared amongst the various people doing the farming, which brought jobs to neighborhoods that didn't previously have jobs. It brought healthy food to neighborhoods that didn't necessarily have access to healthy food. And in addition to those larger plots dug into the ground there, they developed a system of tables and kind of these micro farms, no more than a 1 meter square, that were happening on rooftops, in backyards, on balconies, by a south-facing window, so that people could grow food in a much more proximal way. It's something that they had control over, something that they had attachment to. Now, that particular, the micro gardens, needs some nutrient additives to keep it going. It's a little closer to a hydroponic situation. And right now, to the best of my knowledge, they're still working on a large sort of we will send you the nutrients you need situation, which is, these are compost-based gardens. I mean, this is taking the food waste that would have gone to the landfills and sending it to places to be composted and then turning it into stuff. But we need to localize that a little bit more, get the local farmers a little bit more capacity to develop their own. And, but I think it's along the lines of the worm compost tea, so it should be very doable.
Well, I'm just hoping that when we get through this current economic crisis, that we come out better human beings and we change the focus a little bit. Or right now, businesses and things pop up with a profit motive, and I don't think that's ever going to change, but I think we can change where we add other parameters to what we consider success in a business, and there needs to be this social parameter in addition to profit, and then we won't concentrate entirely on squeezing whatever we can out of a business, and so by making it larger, the profits are bigger. But it may devastate the environment, it may not be as practical, and if we can get back and put more incentive on making these smaller farms profitable, not just financially, but socially, that's what we really need to have. And we're seeing it here and there, and I hope that it's not something urgent that makes us really go to it. I hope that it's just a natural, comfortable transition, but it's very inspiring to see it working in different pockets.
It is inspiring, absolutely. There's a couple of factors that need to happen with that. It's not that a one-acre farm or a 10-acre farm or, you know, something very small like that is the ideal. It's that various products, various methodologies have appropriate scales to them. And so it makes sense that in and around cities, in and around urbanized areas, there would be more farms that would be smaller farms that would be focused on producing things that don't ship well. And that things like grains would continue to be grown a little further out. I guess what I'm trying to say is that there are different scales that are appropriate. And it's a 500-acre lettuce farm is not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But 7 cows on 5 acres is also not appropriate. So it's a, you know, like a, there's a jump there that needs to be thought about for folks. And to me, one of the things that I have a map, it's an upcoming post, I haven't gotten to it yet, talking about places that are local to nowhere. If we define local food as a 100-mile radius from an area, that works pretty well. There's an awful lot that can be done within 100 miles, but if you make 100-mile circles around all of the large cities, all of the cities of any size in the country, there are places that do not have a major city within, or even a minor city within 100 miles. I mean, mm-hmm. there are spots in this country that are local to nowhere. And it's important that we think in terms of both a local food movement and a regional food movement, that we understand that there are some things that make sense to come from a little further away. And I propose kind of a 500-mile radius for a regional food movement.
Mm-hmm.
That gets pretty far. I mean, that's a local food movement for Washington, D.C., would duck into southern Pennsylvania just a little bit and swing around the Eastern Shore a lot. But when you get into a regional food movement, you're able to pull from New York. I think it ducks down into the Carolinas, maybe even clip a little piece of Georgia there, which greatly extends stuff. To use a West Coast example, everybody thinks like, oh, we're still getting it from the same place. We know it's still in California. But D.C. to Atlanta is about the same as San Francisco to L.A. I mean, this is so on the East Coast, you've changed for on the West Coast. Atlanta. It's still California.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't count. Sorry, guys. We busted you. But to make it a little bit larger allows you to pull from further away, so that 100-mile radius around the Bay Area, golly, you've barely gotten down to anything resembling affordable housing.
Yep.
Let alone places to grow much in the way of the foods that work best at larger scales. But by running a 500-mile radius, then you begin to broaden that, and there become places that are more appropriate and crops that are more appropriate and scales that are more appropriate across that larger zone.
Well, the idea is just not to be rigid and to be open to all kinds of possibilities, and that there's not one solution. We're always fixed on one pill for one disease and one solution for one problem, and there's a range of solutions for food.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love technology, and I think we've really come a long way in the last 50 years. When you think about it, it's just awe-inspiring. But it comes with good things, and it comes with not-so-good things. And what I don't like is when we're trying to cram technology down the throats of developing countries when it's not appropriate. And you talked about that the farmers don't wear lab coats. And and we do things here that we, in terms of producing food, and you know, we have genetically modified food and our favorite companies, Monsanto and Dow, and things that
not mine.
She says sarcastically, of course, and we're coming up with things with this notion that we're going to feed the world with these high-tech foods. And the first thing that needs to happen is the lab coats need to come off, because I don't believe in these high-tech foods to begin with, but even if they were superior in one environment, they don't work in other environments.
They don't. A lot of what their actual goal is at the scale of companies and profits is dependency. Their goal is to create dependency. This is why they have the suicide seeds that won't regenerate. So you can grow the crop, but the crop itself will be infertile.
Mm-hmm. That's the scariest thing to me. That whole concept is so scary.
Oh, yeah.
That's like
it's so contradictory to natural logic.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
A lot of the problems that technology is attempting to solve either aren't problems, or they're trying to get one thing to solve somebody else's problem without looking at the larger picture. Now, a couple of examples come to mind there. One was the push to develop rice that had vitamin A in it.
Yes.
Because there were areas that didn't have vitamin A easily accessible. And I always wondered, what did they used to eat? Because before you turned all of this into rice monocultures, wasn't there something that they were eating before? Isn't there vitamin A available in that food system that you are simply have squelched? and
yes,
bring
exactly.
that food back.
What have humans been doing for hundreds of thousands of years in that region?
There's a solution already here.
Yeah, duh.
The other one that comes to mind is the example from the Mekong Delta over in Asia, and several countries got together and began to figure out how to work on damming various portions of the delta, sort of controlling the flood and water cycles a little bit more. And the goal was to clear more land to create more rice paddies, because rice has this wonderful ability to feed a population for about 9 months of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a stretch there where you run out of rice. So the goal was, oh, we got to make more rice, because then we can bridge that three-month gap. Well, the IUCN, which is a major international ecology player, went into the Mekong Delta, did some studies of what was happening in these areas that were being slated to be dammed and turned into rice paddies, and they realized that actually there was more food present before they were putting rice paddies into these areas than after, because the people were collecting wild plants. They were getting not just the wild plants, but the wild protein. The
mm-hmm.
protein source was the ducks and the frogs and the whoever else was around. They weren't asking for their rice to be their protein. They were asking for there to still be wildlands where this can happen. And the countries took that into account. They really changed and backpedaled on what they were trying to do and began to realize the value. And so much, it's one of the things that's marvelous about Asia, is that there's so much wild food collecting. It's a totally common concept there, whereas in America it's absolutely foreign.
Yeah.
It's part of why you see the warnings in San Francisco and in Golden Gate Park there about, no, these mushrooms are poisonous, is because Asian immigrants come over, they are expected to do wild foraging because that's what they've always done.
Mm.
So they go combing through the park, and there's a mushroom in San Francisco that looks very much like one in Asia. The one in Asia is very tasty. The one in San Francisco will kill you.
Wow.
And so that transferring of environment, that, oh, no, there's a subtle detail here that's important. But it comes from this cultural history, this cultural heritage of gathering. Foraging for food is one of the totally viable options for how to become a well-fed person in these areas.
Right, and whereas today in America, if the food hasn't been covered in toxic chemicals and then shipped all around here and there and back again and then gone through like 20 different steps where all the nutrition is taken out and then a few are sprinkled back in and then cook it up into some shape and package it in plastic and put it in a box and then ship it around a little more, that's food.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks don't realize how much gets culled out just at the stage where you say, I need the tomatoes all to fit into packing crates and not bruise easily and ripen on the way to market but not be ripe too fast. Like
right.
The breeding that goes down, the narrowing and selection that happens to get those perfect little red tomatoes, we've already lost huge chunks. Even if we took those same tomatoes and grew them organically, we'd still have lost a huge swath of what makes tomatoes tomatoes if we're working with the ones that were bred to be round, cute, ripen on the way to market, not bruise, not rot.
The whole tomato story, I don't know if you're familiar with Mary Esterbrook's book, Tomato Land. It's just a whole nightmare what's going on with non-organic tomatoes coming out of Florida. And excuse me?
Oh, no, I was just, yeah, that would be amazing. No, I haven't read the book, but
I just
wrote down the name.
It's just crazy and makes me think that every vegetable has another story. Each vegetable has its story of what we do to it that's crazy. And all in the name of profit. And then as a result, the food isn't what nature intended it to be, and it isn't quite as good for us, unfortunately.
Part of it is that we want to eat the same things all the time and everywhere, and I think it's going to be an important element of the local food movement that people begin to diversify their diet, that we've got to give our farmers more options than just cabbages, tomatoes, and peppers. They need more things to be able to grow. They need a variety of harvest times. Like, we can't just keep eating the same things. It's incumbent on people to learn a new food, try something new, pick something else up, begin to experiment so that you're adding burdock, you're adding rutabaga, you're adding tatsoi. Various new things are coming into your diet, which gives your farmers in your area more flexibility, more capacity to find what works for them in their microclimate, with the rhythms of their farm.
Well, isn't variety the spice of life?
Oh, so much of this stuff is so good.
And eating with the seasons is important and can really be fun. Where, we're kind of spoiled at this point, and it makes it kind of ruins the joy in some things. You know, if we can have everything all the time, what's special?
Yeah, and you'd lose the ability to taste the difference. I didn't like tomatoes growing up, and I think it was because I could taste the store-bought quality, but once I got into local tomatoes and growing my own, it was all a whole different ball game. I was like, oh, they have the same name, and that's about as much as they have in common.
Well, what's important, people are, so many people are not interested in fruits and vegetables because they don't think they taste good, and their tongues are so used to sugar, salt, and fat. And and part of that is because we've gotten to this convenient, commercialized business of food where tomatoes need to be perfectly round and look the same so that they fit on a burger perfectly at the expense of flavor. And people don't know what fruits and vegetables are supposed to taste like. So, yeah, it's important to go organic, local, seasonal, fresh, variety, fabulous.
One of the things that is behind what you're touching on right there is the concept of the local food infrastructure, that we've gotten to the point where we have a pretty good farmer-to-consumer connection developing. That wheel is turning. That train is moving. It's picking up its momentum. It's doing what it needs to do. The next step is going to be to develop the infrastructure. The grain mills come to mind. A little bit of food processing, local canneries, and part of that is going to be local kitchens, because not everybody has the capacity to figure this stuff out. A lot of people are working two jobs. A lot of people are, it's totally new.
Yeah.
The learning curve is very steep, and if you've grown up on canned green beans and frozen corn, then how do you learn the next step? How do you move it forward? And so we're going to need community kitchens where people are bringing stuff from the farmer's market to the kitchen. There are cooking classes happening. There are canning workshops. You take your jelly home. You go there, and the farmers have dropped off a pound of strawberries per person, and everybody learns how to make strawberry jelly, and then you make it, and you take it home, and there's a whole kind of re-education. Bill McKibben had a book a long while ago at this point about the age of missing information, about how so many of us know so much, but collectively what we know is often the same thing, and we have to branch that out a little bit.
Yeah, that's really good. I want to talk more about that. I want to talk about a bunch of different things like site analysis, preparing an area to grow food. But I want to take a quick break. So can you stay with us a few minutes and we'll be right back? Great.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. Thank you. Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. My favorite subject, food. And I'm talking with Molly Pfannister, the founder of EatCology.com. Eat, EatCology.com. The blog focused on the nexus of ecology, design, and community food systems. Molly, we were talking just a few minutes ago about how all of us seem to know the same things, and there's just a lot of in this world of all this information, and yet there's so many things that have gotten lost, like how to make food and how to grow food. Can we talk a bit? You have a blog post about site analysis, which I thought was rather interesting, and I guess that's part of your skill in landscape design. I remember a couple of years ago, when Michelle Obama was talking about the White House garden. We're not hearing much about that anymore because they discovered that in the Clinton administration time period, that garden had been fertilized with sludge, and there seems to be a significant amount of lead in the soil, unfortunately. What should people be doing when they start to create a garden or an area for farming?
Knowing the history of the site is pretty important. Something as basic as the White House grounds ought to have really good records. And lead doesn't preclude growing anything. Lead precludes growing and eating certain things.
Right.
Lettuce, for example, bad choice. And there are tests for everything, but nobody that I know can afford to have their soil tested for everything. So if you know your site's history a little bit, you can begin to narrow it down a little bit. It's a good bet in an urban setting that until you have a test that says, no, there's really no lead in this soil, that you probably have lead in your soil. I mean, we had enough years of leaded gasoline driving around in the cities. The exhaust fumes put it into the ground, plus all the paint chips and things like that coming off of the old buildings. If you're in a newer subdivision, you might not have those issues. You'll have other issues, but you won't have those ones. If you're downstream from an old shoe factory, if you're, believe it or not, an old rose cutting place, one of the most polluted sites, it's darn near a gas station. If you're living next to a place where they were growing roses to cut, you better test your soil for some of the intensive chemicals that are used in floriculture. So knowing a little bit about your history helps a lot. There are a variety of options. There are ways to build beds up so that, and you can either, you know, trust that the soil below is going to be able to amend itself, or you can just put a fresh bottom on and start anew with some of that so that you're not getting crossover between the pollutants and what's on top. There are crops that are better at it. Things with shallow roots will pick up the pollutants in the top layer of the soil much better than something like corn, which ends up having very deep roots. Things that grow close to the ground, that pollutant doesn't have to travel very far to get into the leaves. So not only does your lettuce have those shallow roots, but it's got the leaves right there. The lead only had to go 2 inches. It's in the leaf. And then you're going to eat the leaf. A lot of plants have trouble. They'll collect stuff in their leaves, but they won't necessarily collect it in their fruits. So although the leaves of a tomato plant may be gathering the toxins in the soil, the tomato itself is very likely to not have had that stuff cross the barrier to cross into the fruit itself.
Okay.
And that's there's nuances to that, but that's the gist of it, is that there are things you can do. There are always options. You're never completely out of luck.
And then there's not just the soil that's a concern, but water and sun and wind.
Yes, microclimates. Knowing not just generally I live in Arizona or generally I live in Minnesota, but then knowing the microclimates of the whole thing. A south-facing brick wall is very different than an exposed northern section, north-facing section. Like you're getting very different climates, very different lights. It's holding heat differently. The south-facing brick wall may well even have a dead zone right in front of it because it's holding heat too well. It's burning off whatever's in front.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have the capacity to grow there. So those kinds of things can be really fun, knowing who will put up with what, beginning to understand what kind of site you've got. A lot of the most common mistakes that I see, folks will forget entirely to look at where their downspouts are.
Where their what are?
Where their downspouts, the gutters coming off their roofs, will be dumping water into part of their yard. And they'll forget entirely that it's dumping water into their yard. And they'll plant something there that doesn't want that much water. Rosemary next to a downspout is not a good idea. On the other hand, if they plant mint by their downspout, but then they've attached one of those little black hoses and actually have sent the water further under the ground into the culvert, then their yard is getting none of the benefit of the rain that fell on the roof. So the mint by the downspout, even though it's right next to the water going past, the water is inside metal and plastic and will never get to the mint, which would be thrilled to have it there. So you got to look at where your water is, take advantage of what's naturally given to you. If you've got a depression in the yard, find some water-friendly plants. Find some things that can handle having their roots soaked, having their oxygen depleted for a few minutes, a couple days, while the water soaks in to the ground. The other really common mistake is that it's so much more pleasant to work on your garden in the summer when the sun is high. Even if you're going out in the morning to do the work before the heat of the day sets in, you're still setting stuff up. In the summer, you're looking at the sun pattern through the summer, so they'll put in their fall garden, and then come October, they're totally disappointed because nothing's growing, because the garden is completely in shade now because the sun has tipped back down, and then the angle really makes a difference. So that's the second common mistake. A fall garden is going to need to be open to the south. Is going to need the sun to be able to come in at a much steeper angle. And same with a spring garden. It won't fit where the summer gardens go.
Right. So where do you live?
I'm currently living in Lincoln, Nebraska.
And do you have a garden there?
I have a porch with a really great balcony. That's what I can afford at the moment.
Oh, that's okay.
I've got friends in town.
I've got a terrace, and I grow whatever I can on it.
Exactly. I have friends in town who are very much into permaculture, and they let me dabble in their yards as well. But a lot of what I've been doing the past several years has been helping people out, coaching, I don't know if folks are even familiar with this, but there is a movement, a new profession evolving of garden coaches, who are people who can come to your yard, spend an hour with you, tell you what you've got, what you inherited from the last homeowner, and then help you make some plans of, give you some suggestions of how, what could be done and maybe what should be done first, help you prioritize what the next project will be, but with a larger picture in mind so that each of your little projects builds into a coherent whole.
I haven't heard of that, but I like the concept. There's certainly a lot of coaching going on with life coaching, and I think people need a lot of nutrition coaching for food changes. And why not garden coaches? And that seems like something that could a little bit of time up front could really make a difference for the whole season.
Yeah, it really can. And some folks want continual lessons through the season to help them figure stuff out, and other folks just want to check in to figure out why their fall garden didn't grow.
Mm-hmm.
Just little details, everybody's at their own place.
But I want to talk about the word weed for a minute, and it's funny because we choose to, by the words we use, kind of downgrade things that actually are quite beneficial. And some of the things that we call weeds are actually nutritious foods. And we've...
Oh, quite a few.
And some of them now are kind of getting a comeback, and we're seeing them pop up in farmers markets at big prices. But what are some of those unfriendly pests that are actually good and tasty foods?
There's quite a few out there. I would say purslane is a really common one that I see around. It's a very small ground cover. It has a tendency for the fat little leaves like you would see on a succulent plant. It'll bloom in the summer. It's best in the spring. That's before it's gotten bitter. The spring is a lovely time. The trick with purslane is that because it's a ground cover, it's frequently planted or appears, plants itself, along sidewalks, and you need to find a spot where perhaps it's coming over the ledge of a wall. What you're looking for is higher than the height of a dog. Because you don't want to eat what's been the neighborhood restroom.
Yeah.
So you're looking for something coming over somebody's retaining wall or something like that wouldn't have been affected by those natural forces. Another one that's really common that's also really good in the spring is lamb's quarters. Lamb's quarters are part of the goosefoot family. The leaves do kind of look like geese feet. It's actually a relative of quinoa, and if you let it go to seed, you can really see that in the seed heads. In the urban areas, lamb's quarters unchecked can sometimes go, like if they're really happy, they'll go 6 to 10 feet. Most folks don't ever meet lamb's quarters that size. Most folks are only meeting about 2 or 3 feet tall. They'll have sort of a bluish-green quality, but then there'll be sort of a white dust on the leaves. And this is a very common weed. I've seen it all over the country, and it's very tasty.
I get it all the time in my terrace beds. It just blows me away how it grows and how well it grows. But you can eat the seeds as well?
I believe you can eat the seeds.
They're like quinoa, you said.
Relatives of quinoa. I eat the leaves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I chop it up and pop it into the salads and things for the weeds. There's a number of other ones. I'm not a fan of Russian olive, autumn olive. It's Eleagnus umbellifera, but it's something like that. It is a very common shrub that you'll see around. It'll have an orange-red berry in the fall. It grows in a lot of places that are difficult to get things to grow, a lot of roadside areas and highway medians, because it is one of the nitrogen fixers that's actually not in the legume family. Mostly the legumes handle nitrogen fixing in the soil. The Eleagnus is one of the ones, the olive. But it's a weed plant. It's the relative of one that I like much better, the gloamy berry. And I've heard a couple of pronunciations on that, G-O-U-M-I. And those are findable all over the place. You can definitely eat the berries or the ones that are all over. If you were going to plant it intentionally in your yard, I would go ahead and get the one that's actually the gloamy berry instead of digging up something from beside the road. because it's more likely to stay contained within your yard.
Hmm. Are there sites where we can see what these things look like that you'd recommend?
I try to put pictures on them, of them, when I talk about them. There is, I did a little bit of weed discussion. Let me pull it up.
Okay, so somewhere at ecology.com.
Yeah, it's at ecology.com. The article title itself was Glinda the Good Weed.
Are you a good weed or a bad weed? I'm not a weed at all.
Exactly, Glinda the Good Weed. Because I grew up a fan of Dorothy Gale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually, it's ecology.com/Glinda-the-good-weed. And I've got images there of purslane and lamb's quarters. I also have some other ones on there. I have dandelion and onion grass. Onion grass is tasty. Again, it has the dog issue. Mm. I use onion grass as a pH indicator. If I see onion grass growing near a lilac shrub, I need to adjust that pH higher because onion grass will only grow in acidic soils.
Mm.
And lilacs will only bloom in non-acidic soils. So if I want my pretty lilac blossoms
and
there's
do.
Onion grass nearby, I need to...
That's my,
oh, yeah.
That's my favorite fragrance, lilac. That just drives me nutty. They're so good.
Oh, yeah, and the butterflies, too. They're wonderful. So that I use them as an indicator species more than as an edible, per se. There is a variant on clover known as sour clover. It'll bloom in with the other clovers, but where the other ones have white and purple heads, this will have much, much smaller little yellow flowers. Tends to be a bit stemmier, and the stems themselves are what's so tasty. It's a very sour, lemony taste, like you would get from sorrel.
Mm.
And that's very good in salads. Little violets themselves are tasty. The flowers are perfectly edible. I remember walking down the street once. There was a band of daylilies growing beside us, and I was walking along with a woman who I kind of was aware had a crush on me. And it wasn't reciprocated in this particular case, but I wasn't really paying attention to what I was doing. So when I picked a daylily flower, I was aware of some motion on her side. I think she was thinking, oh, my gosh, she's picking me a flower. And I picked it, and I pulled the pollen out of the center, and then I ate the flower because it's like a very juicy lettuce. And she was absolutely flabbergasted. She was like, whoa, what just happened? But daylilies are marvelous. They're very tasty. I tend to like the tall orange ones. I like the yellow ones also. They tend to be shorter, and again, I get into the dog issue. The red ones are a little powderier to me, but I'll pull out the center stems where the pollen is, and the rest of it is just like a juicy lettuce. Wonderful.
Well, I think there's something in our DNA, and that's how what's enabled us to survive. But the idea of being able to roam and nosh and eat is
mm-hmm.
important. You know, as scavengers and picking berries, I love it when I find an area where there are berries growing, and I can just stay there for an hour and just pick berries. It's just such a lovely thing. And, you know, we're so far away from that. And I would love to see that come back. Certainly we're going to have to get...
It is making a comeback.
It is, yeah.
Phoenix, Arizona has some scavenger maps available. I'm not sure how easily those ones are findable. Portland, Oregon has scavenger maps.
Molly, the music means we're at the end of the hour.
Oh,
so thanks for talking with me. I really enjoyed it. This was Molly Femister. Is that how you pronounce your name?
It is.
Yes, and eatcology.com. Please visit it. There's lots of great information. Thanks so much for joining me on It's All About Food.
Karen, bye-bye.
Okay, I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me. Have a delicious week.